Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Vanderbilt's fifth observance of Constitution Day. I'm Susie Coleman Archer. I'm Assistant Provost for Academic Affairs. And for those of you who do not know about Constitution Day, late in 2004, Congress enacted legislation that created Constitution Day. The legislation mandated that any institution of higher education, actually it applied to other institutions of learning as well, but these institutions that were recipient of federal funds were to provide a program about the U.S. Constitution on or about September 17th. Now, in complying with that piece of legislation, Vanderbilt made a decision early on that we would indeed attempt to make Constitution Day an educational undertaking. And so for the past 4 years, we have done just that and wish to do so with this program. We really appreciate your attendance here today, and we are very fortunate to have one of Vanderbilt's best professors to give us the Constitution Day presentation today. To present our presenter, I am going to ask Vice Provost for Faculty, Tim McNamara, to introduce our speaker for the day.
Oh yeah, thank you. I like the promotion. Welcome to this fifth annual celebration, Vanderbilt celebration of Constitution Day. As Susie said, we gather here today to celebrate the U.S. Constitution, its ratification, and those who've obtained U.S. citizenship. You know, when Alexander Hamilton and James Madison and John Jay authored the Federalist Papers 222 years ago, their goal was to defend and advocate for the ratification of the Constitution. And even more importantly, probably in their minds, was to frame its interpretation for the future. But I'm sure that they never anticipated that it would result in a federal mandate on universities, that the Constitution would actually be a compliance requirement. Now, those of you who know me know that in that context, it's especially appropriate that I'm here because I am always, it seems, involved in some aspect of compliance, from accreditation to federal compliance with research regulations. In fact, I think at some point I was calling myself the Vice Provost for Compliance. And indeed, I've been known as a member of the traveling duo called the Rules Brothers. That would be Dennis Hall and myself. In this case, I'm happy to comply and happy to participate in Vanderbilt's compliance, because I can't imagine a better way to spend an hour and an afternoon but learning about probably what has to be the most important document in U.S. history, and maybe even one of the most important documents in human history. It's my distinct pleasure to introduce our speaker today, Professor Bruce Oppenheimer. Bruce is Professor of Political Science and Acting Chair of the Department of Political Science here at Vanderbilt. He earned his bachelor's degree at Tufts University and his MA and PhD at the University of Wisconsin. Bruce has been a fellow and a guest scholar at the Brookings Institution and an American Political Science Association Congressional Fellow. His research and teaching focus on Congress, congressional elections, political parties, and American political institutions. Among his publications are Sizing Up the Senate, The Unequal Consequences of Equal Representation, co-authored with Francis Lee, which was awarded the D.B. Hardiman Award by the Lyndon Johnson Foundation for the best book on Congress. He's also co-editor and contributor to Congress Reconsidered, the ninth edition of which was published this year by CQ Press. First time I read that, I saw GQ Press. I didn't think that was right. CQ Press. Among his current projects are a study of Congress and energy policy and research on why African-American U.S. House members infrequently run for the Senate. One of Bruce's passions in life is baseball. He offers a course on baseball in American life during the Maymester. The title of his presentation is Congressional versus Presidential Influence, the Illusion of a Balancing Act. It's my pleasure to welcome, and I hope you join me in welcoming, Professor Bruce Oppenheimer.
Thank you, Tim.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Tim and Susie, for the kind words and for inviting me to speak here today on Constitution Day. We have to thank Senator Byrd of West Virginia, who introduced the amendment that requires federally funded institutions to acknowledge and participate in Constitution Day in some meaningful way. It allows me to do things a little differently than I normally do. Normally, I like to think of myself as a hardcore, empirically based political scientist who goes out and finds interesting questions, gathers data, goes about testing those questions, and reaching some conclusions that are supported by the data, and talks then generally about the significance of those conclusions. But I feel on Constitution Day I can take that hat off a little bit, and not wearing a powdered wig, which probably would have been more appropriate for Constitution Day, get on a soapbox, because I suspect if we're going to talk about the Constitution and the workings of American government, it's fair that someone who observes and studies American democracy for as long as I have and has spent as much time doing it as I have really have some opinions about American democracy and where it's going. And so I thought today I'd talk with you about some of my real concerns about American democracy and constitutional democracy, and in particular touch on some of my area of expertise, which is talking about the relationships between Congress and the President and what's changed over time. I'm going to talk rather informally today. That is, I have some notes and I'll probably stick to them, but I'll probably wander away from them. And I hope to provide ample time for you to ask some questions, but I like to warn my office audiences about a couple of things. One, I'm a great believer in, and I don't want to tell you the source of this law, what my colleagues in graduate school and I labeled Hart's Law, named after Professor Henry Hart, who was a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin. And it was that academics tend to take on the attributes of whatever they study. I think there's ample, it's sort of like people who look like their dogs, but academics tend to take on the attributes of whatever they study. And in this case, I study Congress, have done a lot of research on the Senate, and therefore the tendency is to filibuster. And my intention today is not to do that to you, and I'll try to watch the clock and move through things that I have to cover to get to the central points. The second point I'd like to make is, I'm always in danger if I make this point in the law school, is that while I'm going to talk about the Constitution some, I'm not a great big fan of original intent. And so you won't hear me talking about what the founders intended when the Constitution was written. I will talk about some things which were set up and why it has changed from that original setup, but I face the reality that we live in a political system which is not necessarily well defined by the interpretation or the exact meaning of a document that was written over 200 years ago, when the population of the country was around 3 million people, less, I would tell you now, than the state of Connecticut today, when there was no Louisiana Purchase, right? The country was limited geographically at the time. And if we're going to talk in technology terms, when there was no steamboat or train, let alone an airplane or an automobile. So those are symptomatic of differences. It is hard for me to envision that the founders could have imagined the geographic scope of the country, or that it would have over 300 million people. If Thomas Jefferson was the most wildly thinking among the constitutional fathers and had the sharpest and broadest mind, although some of you may claim it was John Adams instead, and he thought after the Louisiana Purchase that it would take 30 generations to populate the area of the Louisiana Purchase, and it really took only about three you can, you know, there are limits on their vision. There are limits on their vision. Okay. What do I want to talk today about? I want to talk about what a lot of, I think, serious scholars of American politics and a lot of pundits seem to think about when they talk about the wonders of American democracy. We get caught up on this, the wonders of our constitutional design. And it is this sense that it has this terrific self-correcting feature, that somehow there is this nice pendulum, and that if any part of American democracy seems to get swing too far out of the mainstream, takes on too much power, the capacity exists within the beauty of the American constitutional design for other institutional arrangements and for the public to adjust that, to cause this pendulum to swing back in the other way. And therefore, we don't really have to worry at any point in time that, in fact, one branch of our government will become too powerful, will become out of control, and that the underpinnings of constitutional democracy will be threatened. But if you ask me, the thing that keeps me awake at night, and rarely does anything keep me awake at night, about the nature of American democracy, it is that I don't believe there are pendulums that swing back and forth and adjust automatically. And in fact, I think if you look at the history of this country, and especially perhaps at the last 70 to 80 years, we've seen a swing, yes, back and forth between presidential power and congressional resurgence, but with each swing out further in terms of presidential power, it moves further, and each resurgence doesn't take that pendulum back as far. I sort of make it look that people who believe in pendulums see this balance between Congress and the presidency somewhat as a sine curve. You all remember that much from trigonometry, right? It's the sine curve, right? Nice adjusting. But the sine curve is viewed as on a plane like this. And it may still be a sine curve, but I see the plane on which the sine curve operates looking like that. So that's the basic theme I want to argue with you today and present. And again, not as strongly empirically based, but sort of concerns which exist in my gut, if you will. In doing this, I want to talk briefly about why and when the general movement away from congressional dominance and toward presidential dominance occurred and why it occurred and why it's still occurring. Secondly, I want to discuss why Congress, especially during the recent period of Republican control from 1995 to 2007, not only missed an opportunity to restrain the executive, but as I will argue, ironically gave away congressional power, and how the crises of the last year are likely to extend that trend. My point of view is not a partisan one. That is, I'm not particularly concerned that Republicans were in control. I'm not particularly concerned that this is continuing today with the presidency of a Democratic president. It is not an endorsement or the rejection of policies of a particular president or a particular administration. It is a concern with where is the balance of power within the governing system, and is that healthy for American democracy? Well, where do we begin? I often tell my students, and I think I'll repeat it here, that if a Martian were to land on Earth today and to pick up a copy of the U.S. Constitution and read it and said, "Take me to your leader," that's what Martians always say, I think, the Martians would want to go to Capitol Hill and talk to Congress. After all, they would look at Article 1 and they would see the longest and most detailed article of the entire Constitution, seemingly gives Congress powers to make law in a wide variety of areas, only slightly inconvenienced by the president's veto power and an ability to override that power if Congress as an institution chose to do so. They would look at the enumerated powers, you know, well, yes, the president is commander-in-chief of the armed forces, but, you know, all the money for the armed forces, and they, you know, you look at Article 1, Section 8, talks about, you know, an army and a navy. You know, and then there's this thing, you know, the ability to regulate interstate commerce and then all sorts of things listed below. And then if you're not happy with the enumerated powers, there's that, you know, last necessary and proper clause at the end. And I think any real reading of the Constitution would say there's a reason why the first article is about Congress. And there's a reason why it's the longest and most detailed. And, you know, these founders were concerned about executive power, and they didn't want too much executive power. And they saw in the context in which they wrote it that, yes, these were going to be co-equal branches, but that Congress was the first of those co-equal branches. And this congressional dominance existed through most of the 19th century and into the 20th century. Need I point out that when Woodrow Wilson wrote his book in 1880 about the nature of American democracy, he entitled it Congressional Government. He didn't title it Presidential Government. Even after the election of 1896, and I know many of you may not have on the tip of your minds the election of 1896, the election of 1896, one of the, you know, to the degree that people misuse the term, one of the realigning elections, the critical elections in the United States history, McKinley defeats Bryan, solidifies Republican control of government until 1932. After that election, and the election was fought on two big issues, the two big issues other than slavery of the 19th century, and they were the tariff and currency. Right? Those were the two big issues. And here, you know, Bryan had been defeated. The combined populist and soft money free trade Democrats were defeated. The hard money high tariff Republicans had won. And you would think that Congress would wait for President McKinley to come into office, if we're talking about late 20th or early 21st century presidents, and wait for him to send a tariff message and a currency message to Congress and propose legislation. Well, in fact, the lame duck sessions of the preceding Congress come in and pass their own currency bill and their own tariff bill. They don't wait. They're not waiting around for presidential leadership. Hard for us to imagine that happening today. Even as late as the Harding administration, we can see this tendency of Congress to protect its prerogatives. The Harding administration tried to go to Capitol Hill to lobby on behalf of a veterans benefits bill. Remember, this is the period after World War I. And they literally were told, get out of here, you don't belong. This is Congress's business, and executive interference should not be tolerated. Well, things have changed. Few would describe American national government today as congressionally dominated. Well, that would just not be an accurate description anymore. If the Martians came to you and said, take me to Congress, say, you want to go see the president. Well, why did this occur? Let me briefly talk about some of the reasons. Some of it's very gradual. Right? So even during the period of congressional dominance, there's a gradual movement toward greater authority for the executive, sometimes episodic, perhaps during the Civil War, although Lincoln did beat a fair amount of resistance from Congress. Some of it may be occurring with particular presidents, Theodore Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson. But if you look at the overall trend, there is an argument that can be made that congressional dominance is waning somewhat during the 19th century and through the early 20th century. And it just didn't happen when the New Deal came in. But there are a variety of reasons why you had this movement, some of it more rapid than at other periods of time. Among the reasons which are usually given, and I'm not going to dwell on them in great detail, was the idea that problems were growing increasingly complex. You needed more expertise to deal with them. We weren't dealing with a lot of the issues of the 19th century, which the average person might be able to understand. They were more technical and required greater expertise. And that expertise might not rely on Congress, which was not really very heavily staffed. And as you relied more heavily on expertise, executive leadership took on greater influence. More issues got seen as emergencies, you know, especially in the aftermath of the Great Depression and the bombing of Pearl Harbor. There was a recognition that maybe American government needed to be more responsive. And if you wanted responsiveness, you didn't look to legislatures, you looked to executives. That executives were capable of making decisions, reacting more immediately, and responding to crises. And to the degree that more issues could take on a crisis proportion, that tended to move the American public and Congress itself to give greater power to the executive. Clearly, in the post-World War II era, the growing importance of foreign policy takes on dimensions that also add to the president's arsenal. And one of the things we discover is that lots of policy areas which we thought of as primarily domestic policy areas where we might think that Congress should have increasing sway, increasingly have foreign policy overtones. And when they take on foreign policy overtones, the executive tends to have more influence, and the public, again, is willing to defer more to the executive than to look toward Congress. So, you know, a simple issue, for example, about how much wheat you should grow and who you should sell it to, which sounds like a very much a domestic issue, when the question comes up of whether you should sell that wheat to the Soviet Union in the late 70s and early 1980s, that's no longer a domestic agricultural issue. That's a foreign policy issue, and it's not something which you want Congress to just fool around with and decide on in its parochial means. And I'm being a little pejorative there. That's what other people would say. It's really an issue of foreign policy, and therefore the executive should be more heavily involved. You increasingly got policies which cut across and were more complex and cut across different traditional policy jurisdictions. And you needed some coordination of those policies, and the president could provide that coordination. So another reason to move toward the executive. The growth of the number of issues which came under federal purview, you know, things which previously had been left to states and localities or left in the private sector were all of a sudden the purview of the federal government. And with that, you saw an increase in executive power as well. It was not just that issues were too complex, but the number of issues with which the national government had to deal meant that you wanted greater efficiency and responsiveness. Finally, I'd argue just briefly that there was, especially after the 20 years of the Roosevelt and Truman presidencies, a legitimation, an expectation that we would have a presidentially led government. After all, I told you in the aftermath of the Wilson administration, institutional memory was such that it allowed Congress to move back and displace the president somewhat in its policy leadership, especially in legislative policy leadership. People could remember what things had been like prior to Woodrow Wilson. But after the Great Depression and after World War II, and after 20 years of crisis, when people came to accept greater presidential leadership, it was hard to turn back. A more expanded role for the president vis-a-vis the Congress became standard operating procedure. And as standard operating procedure, people no longer questioned whether the president was stepping beyond what were his legitimate constitutional powers. In 1953, President Eisenhower tried to move back, just as things had moved back in the Harding administration. He decided not to put together a domestic policy program. He thought that was inappropriate in terms of presidential leadership. Well, the newspapers of the time castigated him for it. Congress said, "Why aren't you doing anything?" Effectively, he had to eventually cave in, strange to talk about it, but cave in and produce a domestic policy legislative agenda. It was expected. It was suddenly illegitimate if he didn't do so. Also, we have to realize that in the post-war period, there was a period of general trust between Congress and the president, something which we are less familiar with in the current environment. And under that, there was a willingness when writing legislation to grant the, for Congress to grant the executive great authority, great latitude. Well, those who believe in pendulums perhaps were heartened in the early 1970s when Congress reasserted itself. In the aftermath of the War Powers Act, in the aftermath of the Vietnam War, in the aftermath of Watergate, in the aftermath of what were considered abuses of presidential authority, Congress did a whole series of things to try and reassert itself. To say, we have to regain authority and readjust the constitutional balance again. And Congress passed the War Powers Act, the Budget Impoundment Control Act, started using a vehicle known as legislative veto, which I'll explain in a minute, much more extensively, greatly increased its staff and expertise, and those of us who were studying Congress at the time thought we were seeing a real readdressing of the nature of the balance between the two institutions. Well, the War Powers Act didn't do everything it was supposed to do. In this building, people have studied the legal aspects of the War Powers Act. I'm more concerned with the political aspects. And politically, it was largely defined to try and assert an institutionalized role for Congress in the making of foreign policy, to force the president to include Congress in negotiations over foreign policy decision making. But it is important to realize that the executive, with the exception of the notification provisions of the War Powers Act, never really recognized the legitimacy of the War Powers Act and never really gave Congress a larger role. The Budget Impoundment Control Act did a couple of things. It did create the Congressional Budget Office, which now is a counterpart to OMB, and Congress became less reliant on OMB for data. You accept OMB's data, you accept the president's conclusions, you have your own independent experts. That gives you a certain amount of independence. It established a vehicle which you now are somewhat familiar with in the discussion over healthcare debate, something called reconciliation, which is, without going into great details, because at this time in the afternoon, if I told you all the details about how reconciliation works, you would not need any sleep aid. But to put it very mildly, reconciliation created a process for combining in one single piece of legislation all the changes that would be made to bring existing programs into line with a given budget resolution in a given year. You could do that with one piece of legislation. The irony of the reconciliation process, which was supposed to strengthen Congress's hand in getting control over the budget and not ceding as much control over spending decisions as had been ceded to the executive, by the time they wrote the Budget Act in 1974-75, before it came, only a little over 40% of the federal budget was subject to annual appropriations decisions by Congress. Congress had given away the power of the purse, effectively. But one of the things is, when they really created this reconciliation process, the first person to really use it effectively was not the Congress, but President Ronald Reagan. You know, he turned it on its head in 1981 and used it as a vehicle to really put in his defense spending increases, his domestic spending cuts, and used it also, although they used a separate piece of legislation, for the Reagan tax cuts. He was able to do that all in two pieces of legislation. Legislative veto, which was a wonderful but blunt tool, was Congress's effort to put constraints on the ability of the executive to interpret legislation in a way that wasn't intended by Congress. And they were provisions written into over 200 pieces of legislation, giving the president or the executive branch authority to do something, but giving Congress the right to review specific exercises of that authority. It was a blunt tool. It was probably a pretty effective tool of congressional oversight. But in the mid-1980s, the Supreme Court, doing what it usually doesn't do, issued a very broad decision in the case of Chadha versus the United States Immigration and Naturalization Service, and decided that legislative vetoes were unconstitutional. Now, without going into detail, many of them still exist. But it decided it, I think, on two interesting grounds. One, that it violated the presentment clause of the Constitution. It didn't give the president a chance to veto. It treated as if each exercise of a legislative veto was amending existing legislation, and therefore the president all had a chance to veto it. But second, it said, and this was a 7-2-2 vote by the court, it violated separation of powers. That is, it involved the Congress in executive function. The court rarely as protective of the Congress when the executive violates legislative function. Perhaps the staff increases were the biggest things. Under the Reorganization Act of 1970, Congress greatly increased the staff of its members and its committees, beefed up the General Accounting Office, changed the Legislative Reference Service into the Congressional Research Service, highly professionalized it, created the Office of Technological Assessment, all to give Congress expertise, and I've already mentioned the creation of the Congressional Budget Office. Well, after this period of resurgence, people started criticizing Congress. This supports the idea of pendulums, right? Congress was seen as meddling, amateurish, parochial, sluggish, something that's an institution that couldn't keep a secret, and generally irresponsible. Let me put those in one of your letters of recommendation and see how far you get. these views of Congress have other sides to them, and I don't have time to go into it, but let me say that that was the movement back. We then had a slight interlude in the movement back toward more executive power. You know, one of the side benefits of Iran-Contra scandal and investigations was a little more distrust of the executive for a brief period of time in the late 1980s. Then I thought we were going to enter a period of real change, a real reassertion of congressional authority following the 1994 election, which brought Republicans into control of both houses of Congress for the first time in 40 years, and in which they took control basically on the idea that they were going to move policy authority away from the national government and back to states and localities, and to reduce the governing sphere of the government in general, to move things away from government decision-making more to the private sector. And I thought this sounded perfect. This was going to be something to weaken the executive, because the executive has always wanted to strengthen the national government and strengthen the hand of Congress. Well, what did they do when they came in? One of the first pieces of legislation that passed was to prohibit Congress from passing what were known as unfunded mandates, putting requirements on state and local governments to carry out certain policies without giving them money to do so. Well, that sounds pretty reasonable. You want to limit what Congress does. You want to limit control, federal control of states and localities. Only one problem with it. The only institution of the national government that was seriously limited by this piece of legislation was Congress. It didn't prevent the courts from putting on unfunded mandates. It didn't prevent the executive, for the most part, from putting on unfunded mandates. So, you know, it's sort of saying, well, we're going to disarm, but you don't. The other branches of government don't have to disarm. Then they decided, well, Congress had been bloated. We're going to get rid of staff. Oh, by the way, we're not going to get rid of any personal staff. We're just going to get rid of committee staff. Effectively, they cut committee staff, where the real expertise was in the Congress, by about a third, knocking it back, depending on how you normalize the measures, to about the level it was at in the early 1970s before the effects of the 70 Reorganization Act took place. Oh, it didn't really hurt Republicans who were in control because they had less staff when they were in the minority. They moved to the majority, so they didn't lose staff. It really cut all the Democratic committee staff, but that's another story. They decided to put term limits on committee chairs and on the speaker. Not that the speaker had ever really hit the term limit situation or would, but it created committee chairs with three terms as committee chairs, and then they would be replaced. Well, that weakened Congress vis-a-vis the executive as well. You know, it was one thing if you knew that, and he's still around, John Dingell was going to be there forever as chairman of the Commerce Committee, and you were going to have to deal with him in an executive agency. I mean, that gave you some clout, and the president was going to have to deal with him, as opposed to, we'll have this person who's going to be a chair of the Commerce Committee, and in 6 years they won't be chair of the Commerce Committee anymore. We don't have to worry that they're permanently in control. It made everybody a lame duck almost the day they started. And then the coup de grace was something which became known as a substitute for line item veto, something known as enhanced rescission. Under the U.S. Constitution, the president does not possess line item veto authority, meaning he cannot go into a given spending bill and veto particular parts of that bill without vetoing the whole piece of legislation. A lot of governors have line item veto, but it's not totally comparable. And it was felt that one of the ways to get control of pork barrel spending by Congress and to make the federal government leaner was to give the president this sort of line item veto authority. And they found a legislative way to do so, which was known as enhanced rescission. And again, your eyes would glaze over if I told you all the details of how enhanced rescission was going to work. There are some interesting debates that take place over this, all largely in the context of enhanced rescission and budgetary savings. But nobody realized the following. If you gave the president that power, he would have tremendous clout with members of Congress that he never previously had. Let's say you're Senator X from a given state, and the president wants a Supreme Court nominee confirmed. And he calls you up and says, Senator X, you know, I'd really like to get my nominee confirmed. And by the way, I've got the Public Works Appropriations Bill sitting on my desk. And there's a big highway project in your state. And I just think I'll X that sucker out. Well, people said, you don't have to worry about that because the president started using this power arbitrarily. Members of Congress would take it away. After all, this enhanced rescission was going to be sunsetted. It would disappear, had to be renewed. There's only one problem with that. All the president would have to do is use it once or twice. Then when he called up Senator X about a Supreme Court nominee, Senator X would not have to be told, by the way, I'm going to line item veto out something in the Public Works Appropriations Bill if you don't support me on this. Because Senator X isn't stupid. No. He's been around the block a few times and knows that the president has that authority. And like most exercises of power, the best use is it's most effective when you don't have to use it. So it would be this sort of club that the president would never have to use that he'd have there. Thankfully, in this case, and this is where I'm on my soapbox as opposed to being the analyst, thankfully, the Supreme Court said that this enhanced rescission authority was effectively a line item veto and therefore was unconstitutional. Although it is important to realize we have new calls for changing the Constitution and giving the president line item veto authority. Now, what I find strange about this and what is so ironic is all these things were undertaken by conservative Republicans who hoped to return decision-making to states and local governments and to the private sector and to limit the power of the national government. Yet perhaps with the exception of the Ronald Reagan years and maybe some of the George Herbert Walker Bush years, it has been the president who has wanted to increase the power of the national government, and Congress has been the institution that resisted that. And here they were giving away the store. They were weakening the institution of government, which throughout American history has most effectively resisted granting the executive more authority and taking more authority onto the national government. You know, Newt Gingrich was Speaker of the House and for, you know, a couple of months thought to be the most powerful person in America. He believed the clippings, unfortunately, I guess for himself. But he was also a historian. You know, I don't think he was a very good historian. You know? Well, what have we seen in the aftermath of this? We've seen a conservative Republican president who, you know, has done a lot, obviously, to move things back to states and localities. No Child Left Behind. Prescription drug program under Medicare. You know, the largest entitlement since Medicare got put into effect. The TARP bailout. You know, here's three pages. Congress pass it so we can spend how many $100 billion? The use of signing statements. I'm sorry, I've got to shorten this because I'm filibustering here. The use of signing statements saying, you know, I know Congress has passed this law and parts of it I agree with it, but parts of it I don't agree with and I don't intend to enforce. You know, well, you want to look back to other fairly conservative presidents? The largest expansion of Social Security in the history of the United States took place when Richard Nixon was president. The creation of the Environmental Protection Agency and some other government agencies. under Richard Nixon. A lot of this that happened is continuing under the Obama administration. It's not whether you favor or oppose particular programs of the president, but there is indication, although perhaps somewhat more lightly, that Obama is continuing to use signing statements. And there's very little evidence that Congress has done anything about signing statements. In the post-9/11 period and reaction to the economic crisis of the past year, the public and Congress have been willing to give the president even greater authority. The question is, when does this become dangerous? And the question I'll leave you with is, when do we hit a non-return state? When do we hit a situation where Congress is no longer capable of even swinging the pendulum back? So, you know, if you want to know if something keeps me up awake at night thinking about the problems of American democracy, it's that we really don't have a pendulum that nicely swings back and forth. You know, we have a pendulum that sometimes comes back a little ways, it doesn't come back far enough. And with each new swing, we swing to greater executive power. And then if you worry about these things enough, and I think most people don't, the question to be asked is this a threat to meaningful democratic government at some point? And what do we do about it? You notice I'm very good at telling you what the problem is. I'm less good at telling you what the solution is. So maybe it's a good point to stop. Maybe you have some solutions, and I can rest easy. The Constitution's an imperfect document, and the way it operates has changed over time. And sometimes we should not always think that it is self-correcting. At least in this one area, I'm concerned that there is not a self-correction. And probably, potentially, the biggest long-term threat to, you know, what we think of as democratic government. Thank you.